Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yo, 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 yo! Oh, hey, I forgot. I sent myself a reminder. I'm supposed to give a shout out to Andy at ASUBB who had me out, and he said that was his one request. He's like, give me a shout out on Weird Things.
Yeah, hi, Andy.
And so I am.
Cool. Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends. It's your old pal, Justin Robert Young.
Yes. Well, gentlemen, where should we start? A lot of weird stuff going on.
Dude, there's only one thing I care about. It's that epic Instagram from Elon Musk of the almost landing on the drone ship. You were there for the launch on this one?
That is correct, sir. I took went with a group of people up to Vandenberg. First, we went to Solvang, this nearby Danish village in the middle of, you know, California, as you would expect. Had a, you know, an epic night of Cards Against Humanity, woke up early the next morning, drove on over to Vandenberg. We went to this viewing location. I tried to find what was going to be the closest spot we could get. There were a few other places around Lompoc and whatever where you could view it from, and I was weighing the different ones. I brought with me kind of an Uber SpaceX insider who was able to, you know, check on stuff. One of actually the people who, like, was one of the VCs behind it. So, but we found, like, well, we could go here, but it's further away, but it's got a 400-foot elevation. We could go here. We could go here. And we ended up going to West Ocean Avenue. If you look at that on a map, you can see how close it is. Now, what's different about Vandenberg than Cape Canaveral is Cape Canaveral's in Florida and everything's flat. So you can stand anywhere in Florida and watch it. You're at Vandenberg, there's hills and mountains. It's part of why they chose it, because it's this nice area, this flat area here with hills on one side that could kind of shield explosions and stuff. We go to West Ocean Avenue, and it was miles of cars. Fortunately, I had some friends that went earlier and had spots, but it was insane. There were thousands of people there, and that was just one of the viewing locations that people went to go see it.
That is amazing. So you're saying that that you got a very visceral sense that SpaceX launches were entering the public pop culture consciousness.
I bet this was probably the most attended Vandenberg launch in decades. That's my bet on that. And you also had, they were launching the Jason 3 weather satellite, which measures the ocean surface. And there was a bunch of people there I saw that were involved with that part of it too there. But where I was at was just tons of SpaceX people. So you had a bunch of SpaceXers who worked there were showing up there to be there, but just all over enthusiasts. I booked a hotel room like a week or so in advance. And by the time we got there, you couldn't get a room anywhere. So we show up and it's foggy. It's like super, super foggy. And talked to one of the people I knew who knew what, a little bit more was going on in the operation. Said, yeah, now they can launch in fog, so don't worry. And so the countdown kept going. We could see, we were in front of this hill, and it's kind of, let me see if I can pull up. It's worth pulling up on a map because I want to explain something kind of interesting. If we type in West Ocean Avenue, Lompoc, L-O-M-P-C, and I'll see if Google Maps will have this. It's a very interesting sort of location in that there we go. Perfect. If you switch to terrain, we were at as far as you can get. There's like an intersection there. So we were just to the east of the intersection, okay? Now there's farm behind there, and then that's the launch pad is actually about a little bit south of there, right? There's another launch pad there. So that's hills. That's all hills. It looks flat here, but that's all hills. So where we were, there was a large hill in front of us. There was a NASA facility, and then up on the hills, there was a big herd of cows.
Okay.
And we could not see beyond that. It was just a bank of fog that we're waiting for Godzilla, the Cloverfield monster, or whatever
sure,
to come marching
sure.
through there, right? And then somebody was cool because we couldn't get Wi-Fi or anything, couldn't get LGE, any signal, anything like that. So fortunately, somebody had brought like a speaker hooked up to, I think, a UHF channel or one of the things that does mission control. So cutting out
the internet altogether, you're just getting the actual raw feed.
Yeah, so we're getting a raw feed of what's going on, of the countdown and all that. And so someone put, and that was what's cool is that, like, somebody thought, and that's something I might do in future launches, is think like, oh, let me see if I need to get a UHF radio or something like that to do that, because that would just cool that somebody randomly showed up with a speaker set up and set that and played that for, so we're all here and we get to listen to the launch. And it's funny because there was a delay, so it may have been, I think they may actually have been streaming it or something, because there was a 30-second delay, because he says, let's start the 30-second countdown. 30, 29, rumble, 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 rumble. And I'm like, oh, guys, yeah, it's a delay. And then we never saw the rocket. We were 4 miles away, but we could not see it through the fog.
Oh, good.
We could feel it. Oh, and you could hear it.
Dude, I mean, so that I would imagine it's like all of a sudden the fog turns to fire and it's
not visuals
at all, huh?
No, I mean, some people may have known where I didn't see anything, but again, it was cool. I mean, I've been to a lot of launches. So this was a cool launch where like it was ominous and freaky because you just see this bank of fog and beyond it, you hear this. You know something incredible is going on behind there. So it was an absolutely very satisfactory experience. If we were further away, we could have seen it, but that's, you know, we probably could have been parts of Nevada and seen it. But what was cool was to be so close to feel it in your chest as the power of the rocket engine just vibrates around it.
No, having seen a couple launches, that's something that I've certainly never experienced before. Like you never experienced just that visceral, experience of your body rumbling.
Now, before the rocket took off, there's this herd of cows up on top of the hill. People are saying, well, what are they going to do? What are the cows going to do? And I've seen like the cows at the SpaceX grasshopper testing, you know, the ones that sort of, they're kind of like, hey, look, a rocket, whatever. I'm like, yeah, I think they're probably used to it. And this is also an area that has tons of Minuteman missiles too. But I'm thinking like, I don't know if they're going to really care. They're cows, you know, they're bovine. They don't really do much, right? Oh, I'm wrong.
Oh, no.
So up on top of the hill. You see these cows, all of a sudden the rocket starts to take off. The cows are like, what the hell is that? The cows start stampeding one way, and then they start stampeding another way, and it looks like they're heading towards this NASA hangar because they want to lodge a complaint or something like that. The next thing you know, they start coming in a direction towards us. Now, we're a good distance away, but there's a fence there, but I'm like, those cows are coming towards us.
Like, what happens if we get fast?
What, I mean, are we going to die in a stampede at a rocket launch?
That would be the perfect Weird Things obituary. Andrew Main, creator of Weird Things.
Stampede. Died in a cow stampede in 2016, watching a reusable rocket take off into space.
So obviously, I mean, being there was a huge, huge deal. And I assume that the satellite deployed without incident.
So, yeah, we are, you know, as you listen to the mission control feed, and this was a NASA production, so it wasn't like the SpaceX, when the SpaceX did their private Orbcomm launch, this was a NASA. So NASA TV did it, which is a lot like watching TV in 1989. So what happened is, I guess it was, and it looks like there's the SpaceX has their own coverage of it. So the rocket takes off. They got their first stage separation. The second stage went up, and the second stage would go into, they would do a separation. So it would go into an orbit before it was going to go into its higher orbit. First stage, we're waiting to hear what's happening. We're waiting to hear what's happening to that. And we don't have internet. So it's not like we can check back and forth on that. And so there's this speaker playing the mission control, and then sometimes it would cut out and we'd get weird like electronica music playing.
Oh, really? Because it's just this UHF channel.
So we're gathered around and we hear like, you know, G-minus 222, grade 81, then. And I'm going, I start going, people of Earth, do not be alone. We finally, you know, somebody was able to get through and relayed to us, said, hey, it came down, but looks like there was a problem in the landing, and you know, we knew there was a landing leg problem.
Well, watching the coverage, it was fascinating because they had essentially the world's worst timing for Skype lag. They're showing this amazing video that clearly shows the drone ship. You see that it's high seas. I'm amazed because it's like it's swooping left and right, you know, pitching all over the place. I'm like, how are they going to land on that thing? And then it's like, all right, here it comes, the moment we've waited for. And then they cut to a frozen, like half refreshed image that had just sat there, and is like a little bit of freezy lag happening. okay, we'll let you know how it worked out. And so it's like, oh, son of a gun.
Watch the SpaceX video of that, guys, because it is, to our listeners out there, it's, you're, this is not a, a beautiful day at sea. And that's not why it crashed either, though, is that Musk said that the, you know, the problem wasn't that, that it's a huge challenge to land this thing on a barge. But the problem that they had was it when it hit, there's the of the landing legs, one of the landing legs, one of the four legs, there is a mechanism there that was supposed to keep it in place, but all of a sudden it just gives in and you see this whole thing.
Yeah, check out Elon Musk's Instagram feed for this epic, epic thing. Because it full on, it lands successfully and then just kind of leans a little bit farther, a little bit farther. And there's this spectacular two-stage explosion as different parts.
It's like
parts
a tripod where you forgot to fix that lower leg.
Oh, so amazing.
Yeah, what's crazy about it, again, Elon Musk just killing the game on Instagram. You know, no one's doing it bigger than Elon. It just seems so simple. They conquer so many thought to be impossible engineering hurdles. Only for like one latch not to catch,
and it's accurate, but it's somewhat frustrating when you see headlines like SpaceX successful launch fails landing. And it's like yes, that is not the outcome we wanted, but how many other rockets have we had that have gone launch orbital payloads that have had successful? Oh yeah, the only one, because only one company ever tried.
I mean, if I have to choose from the menu between having the headline reads fails landing and not mention the fact that they're trying to land at all, I'd rather that be the talk. You know,
well, I mean, I guess part of it is it shows you that with momentum comes expectation. Right. And I think that it's very frustrating for people like us that have watched what, you know, SpaceX started from and has eventually become and how much they've done beyond what was even thought to be possible. It's frustrating to look at what they have made very clear is like, listen, we're going to blow a lot of these up,
yeah. You
know, like trying to land them, like this is not easy. And we're trying a lot of different things and we very easily there. No one would blame SpaceX. Maybe they would now, but at the beginning, no one would blame SpaceX for just saying, hey, we're going to try to do this as a press release, you know, and then saying, yeah, we didn't do it. It was close, but no cigar. But again, Elon Musk is putting it on his personal Instagram feed. Yeah, they are doing live streams of it, like so they can show people.
And I agree that you're right. But I guess my issue sort of comes into the, is pointed out in the chat room too, is like, we wouldn't know there was a fault until that happened. There's a lot of these things in early stages. He's like, well, how can this go wrong? No, now we know. Check that down. And we learned from it. And each one of these barge landings has gotten better and better. And it's funny because Musk has pointed out, says, yeah, this won't be our last RUD, you know, rapidly unscheduled disassembly. and that's the fact that he's so, when they were going to do the grasshopper, like, yeah, we're going to try the hover slam. You know, it's like, what's a hover slam? Well, it's going to hover and probably won't work right. So then it's going to slam into the ground and create a crater. And he was like we're going to probably make a lot of craters trying to figure this out.
Also, it's like what I think is lost when people say, oh, a failure to land is like these are all sunk costs from the second they go.
Well, exactly. Yeah. That's the brilliance of it is he's running experimental rocket design on someone else's dime.
This part of it's done on, I mean, yes.
Well, no. It's a paid mission. And what normally would be just a place to, you know, throw it down. It's like, no, this is an opportunity. This is unused experimental time for us.
And absolute kudos to NASA for supporting this. NASA could very well say, hey, we only want you focusing on getting our payload into orbit. That's what we want you to do. None of this, you know, trying to, you know, land a rocket chicanery. You can't do that. They've been super supportive of that. And I know we've often sometimes come across as we've had a problem sometimes with the way that NASA has to operate and the bureaucracy and the way the cost plus, you know, contracting and programs like, you know, I'm not a big, you know, I don't think SLS is really going to be the future of NASA, their big rocket, you know. There are a lot of brilliant people working on it, but I think there'd be better stuff. But anyway, but we are absolutely big NASA fans, super big NASA fans, and grateful for NASA to be supportive of this, you know, like Orbcomm was and whatever, to say, yeah, you know, we trust you guys enough that you're going to get our payload to orbit, and we're totally cool with you trying to, you know, make this work.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but they were mentioning that the drone ship was named, please read the instructions, which is all of a sudden it occurred to me like, wait, are they reusing the same drone ship or are they?
It's a new ship, but they did the, use the same name.
Oh, okay. Cause I loved the idea that it was the same ship and all it did was just get slammed into by rockets over and over and over again.
Why did these things survive? No, I mean, these things survive that, you know, but to my understanding, I think this is a different barge cause this is. I could be wrong on that, but yeah.
So I think part of it also for SpaceX, the pressure's in a different position because they did successfully land one of these things on solid land, which you know, proves the concept at least and doesn't put the pressure on them. Having them landing it on a barge now seems like a more interesting version of the impossibility they have already proven to be possible. What is, I mean, I guess they're in a weird position now where it's like, when they do this, it will be a big thing. But I almost feel like now that they did land something on the ground, we're already, our eyes are also, are already on like, so when are we going to put another one of these things up? Like when do we get on the other side of this, of this reusability question?
Yeah. Well, and also here's the other thing is, and I don't want to ascribe machinations where there aren't any, but it was interesting to see that there is much lighter attendance when they showed the feed in SpaceX. There was a lot fewer people there than were there for the ground landing. And it occurred to me like, the difference is I'm sure that all of these things are scheduled out in advance and like, okay, for this launch, we're going to launch on this trajectory. There will be no opportunity for a ground landing. But again, this is the crazy genius of Elon Musk. He's like, screw it. Let's throw a boat out there.
Less people at SpaceX watching this one because it was feasible to leave, you know, where SpaceX HQ is and be with the thousands that were up there with Andrew.
Interesting. Yeah. No, that's a really good point. I didn't think about that. But I guess what I was saying is it makes me wonder if way early on they knew with a strong level of confidence that they would be able to pull off a ground landing, but to get some practice in, they just did this. They started doing barge stuff, knowing that it was highly unlikely that they would work, but that I don't know. I feel like for how well and smooth that ran over and for how much they invested on very publicly doing the ground landing, it was sort of like, you know, Fat Man and Little Boy. Little Boy, they didn't never even tested. They just were so certain that atomic bomb was going to work because it was just a dumb gun and the numbers worked out. Whereas the other one, they, of course, did real tests.
Yeah, well, this was, remember, because this was a NASA launch. NASA got priority to cover it. So that's why it wasn't a SpaceX event where –
No. I mean, when SpaceX – on SpaceX coverage, they showed people there. It looked very similar for it. But I guess my point is just behind the scenes, I'm wondering how much earlier they were certain that they were going to nail that.
It's interesting. Like, yeah, but like every SpaceX employee who was not at work was there today – was there yesterday watching. The difference is that like – there's with the barge, you know why they did it, why they decided they're going to land on a barge?
Well, I believe because it's fuel costs, right? Where it's like you want to be where you can use your fuel to decelerate correctly.
Yeah. It has to be, well, normally they're working on barge landing because at a certain point the rocket's too far out, too fast to be able to come back to the pad, right? As you said, that wasn't the case here.
Ooh. Was it just to practice the bigger difficulty or?
They're waiting EPA approval to be able to come back to the pad.
Ah, interesting. So it's like some kind of spotted barn owl that might get scared of a rocket
landing.
Actually,
a snail.
Is it really? It really was
a
snail?
I heard it's a snail. I heard there's a snail that.
What's with these Luddite snails?
Yeah. So I just thought that was kind of, but it was like, again, they wanted the barge practice because that's. There are going to be many missions where the rocket's not going to be positioned to return to pad. Now, there's been a little bit of trash talk between SpaceX and Blue Origin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. What did he say?
Just to give you a sense, and I don't know if Andrew mentioned this before, but from Hawthorne is where SpaceX is, right? Mm-hmm. Suburb of Los Angeles. To Solvang, it's only you know, 2 hours and 46 minutes. So it's like, you know, that was a very, very doable trip for enthusiasts like Andrew and his gang of merry men and women, as well as all the employees there at SpaceX. But let's get into the poop talk.
So the problem comes down to Jeff Bezos, who we all have a lot of admiration and respect for, and I'm very excited to see where Blue Origin goes. They're actually developing orbital stuff and all that. He filed a patent in 2009 for landing on a barge, using a rocket for landing, you know, landing on a barge. So basically, he's tried to lay claim to this, and there has been an ongoing legal battle in the courts between SpaceX and Blue Origin over whether or not, you know, and right now.
I swear to God, if these bastards who locked up the one-click purchase and ruined it for everyone else, if they do the same thing for space barge landings, I'm going to lose my freaking mind.
this has been, and this is, you know, stuff that you know, if you are around SpaceX people, you get a whiff of it. There is a great frustration that, you know, for as much but what we see on Twitter, you know, the soft snark that exists where do billionaires, you know, cast shade on each other on social media for their rocketry exploits. That is the tip of the iceberg, and what goes below is everything else that you know, two billionaires who are trying to not only rapidly expand what we can do, but also do it before the other one.
And the problem too is with the patent is that I mean, you know, we could go on to when how novel is of how original things are, when there might be a case for it, but this was already described. There was a paper by Yoshiyuki Ishijama in the collection of papers, Reentry and Terminal Guidance for Vertical Landing, Two-Staged Orbit, published in 1998, nearly a decade before Blue Origin tried to get a patent, or, you know, actually a decade over before they got the patent on it. So this is a paper of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And, you know, so there's that. And there's been other descriptions. We've had other things of, you know, we've had recoveries of other types of vehicles and stuff on ocean-based platforms. It's arguably, you know, a thing that's been done before. And again, you know, people are like, I'm going to make a patent on this. Well, if it's clearly been done before, no, you don't get a patent on it, you know. But that's the case here, where it looks like there's been talk. It's been talked about much, much before. There was discussions of, you know, both sea launch and sea landings, et cetera, and all that. And that, you know, and I got into a discussion with somebody on Facebook, which I regretted doing. It's like, well, that's just business. I'm like, no, there's good business. There's bad business. You know, there's Blue Origin's going to probably lose this. You know, they already lost, you know, one judge's decision. And what's going to be the outcome if they win is they get to say, no, you can't do this, you know, or you got to pay us an exorbitant fee until we do it. And for something that shouldn't be, that area should definitely not be patentable, you know.
Yeah.
So that's my that's the frustrating thing that I have with Blue Origin is that there's the middle of this. We're having very talented people being tied up and wasting their time on something that's, you know, clearly, it almost seems mean in a sense, like, hey, I'm behind on this, but I'll get a patent on this and try to stop you there.
Well, and there's so much, you know, we saw similar things with back when I was doing computer stuff. There was, you know, AMD made their bones by mimicking being able to use the same hardware as Intel chips, and then they were the low cost alternative, and so they were always behind Intel, but then they were helping to keep Intel moving forward. Well, Intel figured out that it's easier to just get an injunction and say, well, we've copyrighted our chip our chip things, mm-hmm. and you can't do that anymore. So then again, when you use the law as a hammer, you don't get efficient solutions. You just get a bunch of weaselly nonsense. And so, of course, what AMD did is they said, okay, well, that hardware, we're going to use the same off-the-shelf hardware as you, but don't worry, we're going to change our voltage. So while it's mechanically compatible, it's electrically incompatible. But we're able to keep our costs lower. And it's like it did nothing to stop them. It drove me nuts.
No, yeah, and I mean, by the way, Dr. Payne in the chat room sounds like a real Justin Hammer move, which is maybe the only Iron Man 2 reference that I feel like should ever survive.
Yeah, there's a difference between when, you know, also like if your company's been spending hundreds of millions of dollars on research on something and you're like, hey, we want to have a market window for this, or we're behind, oh, you know what? They didn't lock this thing up. Let's go in there and describe this thing or describe a bunch of things and just use that and the patent troll thing. And again, it gets into a whole thing, but it's
our producer, Tara Cates, has pointed out here in the chat room that according to an Orlando Sentinel article, they have dropped the barge, Blue Origin dropped the barge landing patent.
To my understanding, they dropped part of the claims to that.
This was in September, and the article says that they've filed for a reissue.
Yes. They changed the claims of which they're going on.
But I wasn't able to find anything new.
But this is still something that is internally vexing to SpaceX.
And it's still in the courts. No, it was like there was to my understanding is that there's still other provisions they're trying to, you know, it's being picked up again. Like if you go to NASA Watch, whatever, it basically Blue Origin has said, well, we're gonna refile under this other thing, you know.
Ugh.
So like they had like 13 claims canceled, but again, it's to my understanding, and I may be incorrect on this, but it's a thing that they're still trying to push on.
Yeah, they're still trying to do, which is very frustrating, and for, you know, what has largely been what I think space enthusiasts like us have kind of found so frustrating about the previous, you know, kind of 20 years, you know, starting the clock about, you know, 3 years ago, going backwards of space development, is that it was all about, well, you know, we could, but, and a million different little reasons. And the idea that that was the new normal. And this in what has since been this kind of era of sort of unbridled, just do it. You know, we got the money, we got the brains. Let's just go ahead and try. Let's just go ahead and make this happen. Let's launch this. Let's try reusability. Let's put it into either near, like low Earth orbit, like what Blue Origin has done, or you know, even more impressively, what SpaceX has done. And let's just go. It's like to see this element of like, no, like whether it's bureaucracy or just stuff being tied up in the courts because of lame, you know, patent stuff. It's just like, we have like such amazing momentum right now. We have such amazing, like the fact that we get to do this show and to the point where we've had people be like, oh, come on, it's Weird Things. Talk about more Weird Things. It's like, listen, like this is a hallmark of our era that we get to talk about these exciting new things, because previous to this, they just didn't happen. You know, it was a lot of like, well, you know, 5 years, maybe we'll be able to get the funding to do something that looks like this cool drawing.
Ah, it's too bad, though. I mean, it's like, you know, let's face it. We're just dancing on the grave of space progress. We stopped dreaming, gentlemen. We're not heralding.
I went to go watch a launch guy, and it was a ghost town in the middle of nowhere. Nobody. I'm like, me and the cows.
Yeah. By the way, the Millennium Falcon sucks, and I don't know why people are getting mad at me.
By the way, he said it could have so easily rolled into, well, it's like, well, no, it's a small ship. Now, if you want a good discussion, let's talk about a Star Destroyer but instead he goes on Conan and just doubles down. We're like, I don't understand why it's even a thing. We love you, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah.
Hearts. We love Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hey, man, and you know who we love even more than Neil deGrasse Tyson? Our fantastic patrons. If you go to patreon.com/weirdthings, you can join.
There's 429 people that we love more than Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Dude, he's number 430 on our list. I mean, he's way up there. It's just that, you know, I'll tell you what, if he wants to become a patron, we'll love him. He'll be at the top of the list.
He'd be 430, Brian, because those 429 were first.
Oh, wait. Ooh, late to the party, huh?
Yeah. Yeah,
do your part to push Neil deGrasse Tyson further down the list of people we love by supporting patreon.com/weirdthings. Thank you guys so much. Hey, again, an era not too long ago when we just would have said, you know, Justin's traveling, Andrew's got watching the SpaceX thing, it'll make for a great episode next week. Let's just cancel the show. Not so much now, because we have your support. Thank you guys so much.
Heck yeah, man.
Gentlemen, I'm going to ask you a question now. Is how weird do you want to go? Do you
want
to go?
I want gross? Maximum weirdness. Set the turbo combobulator to maximum weirdness.
All right, here's what we're going to do for maximum weirdness here. A hunter, hunting things, as hunters tend to do, shot a mountain lion. Have you heard this?
No, but I know that.
There was something unusual about the mountain lion. Care to guess?
Okay, well, first of all, as I understand it, mountain lion is a general term that lay people use. They're usually technically either a panther or a cougar. I don't know. I may be misremembering that or whatever, but if you shot a mountain lion, my guess is you don't think twice. It's like, hey man, that's not a house cat. Let's take it out.
All right. I got a thought. I have not read anything about this.
I'm dodging the chat too. I'm refusing to look at the chat here because I'm afraid somebody will.
Do you guys remember? Was it sheep? That there was a dude disguising himself as
Jeez, yeah, something like that.
Dude, this is why, like, when we were pitching early ideas for shows, one of the segments that I was in love with was dressing up as a Sasquatch running around the forest. But then I realized I would be so very dead.
Yes. It would be an amazing crossover episode.
Or with, Patreon money with for us Buck guys. Tennessee. You know, Brian, no more. Bryce, Justin, and I. Yeah. You know. Bryce is already in the room, ready to take up the space.
You only have to change the last three letters of his name, too. Yeah.
Goat. It was a goat. A goat man. I think it was a goat man. But it, was it maybe a guy dressed up like a mountain lion that got shot?
Well, this was a mountain lion. This mountain lion got shot.
Okay, all right. So not a man with a man's courage. You know, he's nothing but a man.
I'm gonna guess it wasn't something obvious, like of exceptionally large or small size. Is the size the tricky part of it?
No, and I'm gonna It's nobody would ever guess this unless we played a very long game of yes or no, yes or no, yes or no. Okay.
Was it a mutant?
Yes. Yes, it is a mutant, Brian.
Oh my God. Is it? Somebody just wrote it in the chat room and I almost don't even want to see a picture of it if that's what it is.
Wait, well, let's see right now in the chat. I see full of snakes, which would be amazing. Imagine if you shot in that mountain lion and like a pinata, it exploded with just a ball of sex and snakes.
I was grossed out by this, and I'm like, but I do a show called Weird Things. It's kind of my duty.
All I did, I just saw it in the chat room, the mutant mountain lion with teeth all over its face.
No, that's not correct. Justin, that's not correct.
Oh, not correct.
That would have been amazing.
The teeth are not all over its face. They're at the back of its head. Totally different.
What? Okay.
Bryce, do you have an image?
I do have it. I'm going to hit it in 3, 2,
all right, here we go.
1.
Okay, it's my new spirit animal. This thing is so metal.
I want somebody to just put a metal, like, you know, just put a half gray gradient on that and just put any metal, you know, a Pantera, like dude, right in the bottom corner.
I want that on my high school football team's jersey.
the fighting two jaws.
That's right.
What looks like on top of its head is essentially like a lower jaw coming back out with teeth. It looks like it was probably a fused, like in when it was in gestation, there was another mountain lion, and it looks like this probably absorbed part of that fetus.
Yeah,
and which happens, like, you know, more people are chimeras than we realize.
It occurs to me that not everyone knows what a chimera is. The way chimeras popped onto my radar was reading a story about a woman who had a disease, and she was checking to see if she was think she needed a kidney from her kids, and they tested the kids, and they said, sorry, none of your kids' kidneys are compatible with you because you are not genetically related. And she's like, wait, what? You're like, yeah, these aren't your kids. And you're like, I'm pretty sure they are. I was there. And then they went and they found out that she was a chimera. Just as a single fetus can split into two, or a single zygote can split into two identical genetic twins, the reverse happens. Sometimes you get two fraternal twins that absorb into each other. Sometimes it manifests itself as maybe like there was a seam in the middle of the eye where one set of DNA is running the show and another set of DNA runs the other. So in this case, it looks like an absorbed chimera.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly. Somebody said, well, it's an adult line. Yes, it was born and it grew up with part of its lost sibling fused into probably. I have a friend who has one of the eyes with the two-color eye tone. You know, like one part of the eyes. Remember our friend back in Florida, Matt? He had blue and brown eyes. And he had he has a fraternal twin brother. And there probably could have been a triplet. No, not one in the other either head, but one eye that one iris.
As a matter of fact, my daughter Calliope has she has blue eyes, but the left eye is half blue and half brown. And at first I was like, oh, sweet, is she a chimera? And they said, no, apparently that can be just a pigment thing in the eyes, but or it could be a chimera thing as well. And there's cases of this with
she gets two times the birthday presents now.
Hey, also for Brian and Bonnie, that's a narrow miss. Narrow yeah. miss on twins for the last go round.
Oh my gosh. So in the chat they're shouting, oh sweet, she ate another baby. I remember as a kid seeing on That's Incredible, I think they called it The Man with Two Faces. And it was a case where his head was, there was one dominant head and there was another one that was kind of like half at a 45 degree angle superimposed. He was Asian, if I remember correctly. And as he opened his mouth, both mouths opened simultaneously. It was astonishing. That's back when they could show that stuff in primetime to children.
Oh my God. All right. Yeah. No, that's gross. And
Morty, it's Cronenbergism. It's Cronenberg. It's
a perfectly legitimate disease, Morty. Yeah.
Sometimes art, science is more art than science.
Dude, that is a wicked, wicked. And the poor mountain lion, she's running around. It's not like they got mirrors out in the mountains. All the other mountain lions are whispering behind his back. He doesn't know what the hell's happening. He's
or
just
are
like,
they too afraid to? Because they see those fangs looking at him behind the back.
No, how many times does he have to say
somebody?
How many times does he have to say, "Stop talking to the back of my head. You got something to say? Say it to this face, Mister."
My face is up here.
My other face is down here.
Oh,
all right, gentlemen.
Geez.
I got another why. Why did this happen? Why did this happen?
All right.
It's our new segment, Why Did This Happen?
A Spanish court sent a farmer to prison.
Well, that's he was growing the weed, right? He was growing the reefer. He was growing the poppies?
No, fumar de marijuana?
He was growing the coca.
So he had, basically it's for fraud, and he had a very elaborate plan involving a faked car wreck. And insurance money.
Okay, so he happened to be a farmer. Wait, did he just like drive his car into a lake or something?
And then I realize I probably should have structured this differently, but they found him at the site of the accident, and he was smoking a cigarette, kind of really chill.
So, hola, señor. Mi nombre es Spiro. Este es la fuge.
Si.
Are you okay? Are you okay?
He waves to you, and you realize that his right hand is a stump with a tourniquet.
Oh! You lost. Oh my goodness! Is that fresh? Can I examine that?
Oh no!
No, you can examine it. No, it's.
See.
It's see, not see, there. See.
Okay. So, all right, man, this is a, what happened? Did this get severed? Were you in a car accident? Was there a car accident?
Oh yeah. Horrible accident. That car accident's that's how this happened. You know, you can lose hands in car accidents. Happened to Michael Caine.
Hold on. Wait, did it happen to Michael Caine?
Lost his hand in a car accident?
In a movie.
Oh, okay. I was like, that's amazing acting that I never noticed.
I move so fast that you can't notice.
So this happened, what, today? Today it happened?
A couple days ago.
This is the court stuff, Brian. This took place a while ago, and they...
All right. So guy with the stump...
No, I'm asking the guy with the stump, not you, Andrew.
Oh, yeah. God. Yeah, right. Here's the car. Here I am. Here's the stump is bleeding. Still bleeding.
So, let's get you to the hospital.
Sir, what were you traveling with in the back of that automobile?
It's just me. I just drove into
And wait a minute. Now let me take a look at this car. Is it crashed into something?
Well, it's burning right now. It crashed into an orange grove and it's on fire. But you peek inside of there, maybe you put out some fimes, and there's a hand. There's a hand that matches. It's like that's this guy's not having a hand. That's clearly a hand that matches him.
All right, listen.
Give him a hand.
Come here. Here, sit down. Sit down, senor. Let me tell you a little fairy tale. And you don't have to say I'm right. Just kind of look scancy pants if I'm getting close. Seems to me like a farmhand like you might work with some heavy machinery from time to time. A man like you maybe working with a combine or something, and maybe an accident were to happen. Your hand got lopped off, and then you realize you don't have any insurance, but you do have car insurance. And maybe you just grab that hand and run on over, hop behind the wheel of the car, crash your car, figure you get yourself a shiny automobile, maybe a nice three-sided serrated blade robot hand at Geico's expense. Does that sound familiar, senor?
No.
Oh.
No, I did not have a farm accident and accidentally cut off my hand.
Wait, hold on.
Some kind of crazy animal come in and attack you and bite off your hand?
Hang on. Now, you wouldn't be...
I swear. Yeah. I'm trying to ask the real questions here.
The fudge? I respect your style, but I'm chasing a beagle here. You wouldn't happen to be one of those kinds of people that think maybe it's worth cutting off your own hand to get some kind of fat cash payday, would you?
Me.
So apparently, the man from a rural region of Castellón in eastern Spain decided to hacked off his hand with the intent to collect the insurance. And they're not sure if he had any assistance in this or if he did it by himself. Drives his car into an orange grove, throws the hand inside, sets the car on fire, lights up a cigarette, and waits for emergency people to show up, and tries to collect $2 million in insurance.
And so I guess at some point the doctor's like, yeah, there's no way this happened during an auto accident. Look at this serrated edge. Only a fine Ginsu blade would be able to cut with such precision.
I guess that was sort of the decision that was made. And they say that an insurance salesman in Germany was found guilty in 2014 of insurance fraud after he sawed off his own finger and thumb to collect what would have been a 1.4 million euro in payouts.
God.
Okay, all right. I almost feel like they should each get a couple hundred, though. Like, you know, if you're that stupid, yeah. Just whatever. Just take a couple hundred so you can just not feel so bad.
They're like, I'm sorry, you're going to prison and you get no insurance money. However, the court does award you 2 six-packs of Corona. Enjoy.
Yeah, you know what? If I were a bailiff, I would just slip a couple 20s in his pocket and just say,
answer to this. This is what we do. We ask, like, what's the settlement? Oh, $2 million? Okay, here's the deal. Put $2 million into a bag. Shake the bag. Shake it up. There's the money. Now reach inside and grab whatever you can. No. With the stump.
Oh, geez. No, you should put him into the, what's it called? You should put him into the big money chamber where you like have the fan and they blow it up and tie your good hand behind your back and you can keep whatever you have.
Covering his stump with honey and he's just going to wave it around.
Weird things, justice.
Welcome to Weird Things Courts. The plaintiff, insurance company.
Oh, what's the what is the Vosotros form of stupid ass?
Dude, I mean, can you imagine? I assume the guy got thrown in jail for insurance fraud, right? Or had some kind of penalty. I mean, how do you explain that one in prison?
Exactly. And that's gentlemen, do you want to do one more?
The legend of El Stumpo.
El Stumpo. Yeah. Rock it.
So, there was the talk about we might have an alien megastructure.
Oh, yeah, because we had a little, you know, like, hey, how you doing there? I'm a star. Wink.
Yep. So ever since KIC 846-28532, not to be confused with KIC 846-28533, which is a total jerk, astronomers have puzzled over what the heck could be responsible for the star's logic-defying light curve. This is from Gizmodo, by the way, Maddie Stone's coverage. And it has this weird, as Brian points out, this erratic behavior, sometimes dropping by as much as 20%. And they're like, oh, well, geez, you know, this is weird. Maybe it's a Dyson sphere. You know, maybe it's aliens, you know. Aliens? You know, it kind of is sort of, you know, the obvious conclusion. We don't know. Aliens. Well, that was one theory thrown out there. Then somebody else said, you know what we think? We think it's a bunch of comets orbiting it and causing this fluctuation, right? It's like, oh, okay, that sounds cool. But then somebody else said, you know what? Let's study the comet hypothesis. And Kepler, which is the observing satellite that we've been using to
make telescope, is the one for which we named my dog.
Sweet. We've been finding, you know, planets, all sorts of stuff. We only have data going so far back, but Bradley Schaefer, Louisiana State University, decided to look at photographic plates going back to the 19th century of that area of the sky. And from the plates, he says, over the last 100 years, KIC 8462852 has its output has increased and faded by, or the output has actually faded by about 19%, which people or experts say is not, they've never seen an F-type main sequence star do that. So mystery deepens. We don't know.
So I mean, could it be just a nutty arrangement of just a ridiculous number of planets that are you know, flittering and fluttering and covering giant gaps of it in an erratic manner?
I don't know.
maybe.
I believe there is an explanation. And given my knowledge level, I would say that is an explanation that could be one of the explanations.
We'll leave it to the pros.
We don't know. It's what makes it cool.
Who do we – all right. Like, so who would be the most knowledgeable person on this? Because I assume that there are people that are talking about it that – don't make it to BuzzFeed, where I saw alien megastructure mystery gets even weirder with this news. Like, I just kind of feel like, I mean, like, I don't know. I feel like there's somebody who's just like, oh yeah, you know, I don't know. It's a phase of moon vapor.
I mean, that's always a good question. Oftentimes we hear about these things, and it might be an astronomer who's maybe not as published as other astronomers, but in this case, there's a, you know, this got gained attention, or actually, this is from today. Nobel Prize-winning astronomer has suspicions about the megastructure with an update. So obviously, they probably misquoted somebody. So this is
with
a,
an update. Like he said, stroking his cat menacingly, it was stricken from the record.
So apparently, this is. Oh, it's Bradley Schaefer, actually, the one we mentioned. He's the one that published the paper in that we talked about. And so he seems like a pretty credible guy. I mean, he's not saying aliens or whatever. He's just saying like, hey, this comet explanation maybe doesn't make as much sense about it.
So if you wanted to put the word out to the galaxy and the surrounding universe that if you wanted, let's say, as some people would argue, actually moving from star to star is so impractical and so impossible and it can't be done. But the best you could do is just shout to the galaxy that you're here and you existed and here's the story of your world. Could you do much better as far as getting the word out than creating a Dyson sphere that works like a lighthouse flipping on and off?
I'm sure you could do a lot more efficient, a lot more better. I mean, if you're building Dyson spheres, going star to star ain't a problem if you've got time. You know, we were very dismissive about, you know, going from star to star when time was a factor. And then we were stuck into the idea of having our fragile human bodies on board spaceships. But in a world of artificial intelligence and smaller space probes and stuff, you know, if you're capable of building Dyson spheres, you're capable of
sending
reaching
pods, sending spores throughout the galaxy.
Probes, things like that can communicate, you know, at, you know, regular light speed abilities. And so you could build a network and all that sort of that. So, but that's, you know, what could this be like? And that's the thing is like, we're 21st century people with really savanna like ideas about how things work, trying to comprehend what could be done on that scale or why.
Man, the lead on this post about this in on newscientist.com, the weirdest star in the cosmos just got a whole lot weirder. And yes, it might be aliens. This is all about Professor Schaefer's refuting the comet theory.
Yeah. So It could be, I don't like, so Brian, you suggest it could be maybe, it might be, and it might be kind of signaling that we're not aware of or whatever. I don't know. I think that if you wanted a signal, you would use, you could direct, you know, we could target lasers at specific planets using line of sight. Like we could use Kepler to say, well, oh, here's
I guess that's what I'm saying. And that is effective for sending a direct message, and it would be more efficient. But I guess if you wanted to shout the loudest so the whole galaxy could hear you, that's what I was imagining in terms of, you know, flicking on and off or whatever. But I'm sure, you know, smarter people than me have already thought through all this stuff.
And I, you know, we shouldn't discount the idea that perhaps it could be a form of alien technology, and that the goal of that technology is perhaps it intermittently to harness the sun's energy to transfer and change into some hyperspace particle beam that you could use to let the Republic know that they should not be supporting the resistance.
Okay. All right. hey, that's a good segue. You guys want to talk picks?
Yeah. By the way, did you see the Adam Driver, Kylo Ren on Undercover Boss?
So good.
I was kind of flat on it. There was only one real laugh out loud moment. I think it runs the uncanny valley of you know, they did such a good job of the effects and everything that it was less funny for it, you know?
How much have you seen of Undercover Boss?
I mean, I've seen a couple episodes, and I know they hit it note for note. And I
found it funnier as an Undercover Boss parody than I found it as a Star Wars. Like most of the humor for me came from the super reality TV third act, beginning of the third act, or end of the second act admission from the employee that he's had a real rough year and you know his son died and that kind of stuff. Like I found that really funny. And I just really love the fact that like we now live in the world, right? Where it's like we went and the Donnie and Marie show, we were laughing how hilarious it was that it's like, oh my God, look, and they have young Mark Hamill a year after he shot Star Wars, like reprising his role as Luke Skywalker, that like we're living in that world. And you know, he's so committed and into doing Kylo Ren in such a funny way that,
well, that's for me, I thought the writing was typical of what you expect from SNL right now. Take that as you wish. Adam Driver was great. Adam Driver playing this even more emo-y version of Kylo Ren. Like, that was watching him in the scenes and like, oh, what do you guys think of Kylo Ren? You know, just the conviction at which he does that, you know, he just is, I thought that was like the best part. I mean, he was such a great Kylo Ren, and it was so great to see him, you know, play this, you know, sad man. you've seen, what do you think his lightsaber? I'll get his lightsaber. I'll show you.
No, it's good. And shockingly close to the actual character of Kylo Ren.
I thought it was funny. All right, picks.
Hey man, I got a hot new release that just dropped this week. It's burning up the charts. Your iPhone will never be the same. It's a brand new game, the likes of which you've never seen.
My pick is Pocket Mortys.
God damn it. No.
I played a lot of Pocket Mortys this weekend.
Yeah, dude. Pocket Mortys. You know, I was, I think, in high school or college when the Pokemon craze first started, or maybe just out. But it was like I was at the wrong time. And my daughter's into Pokemon, but it's like, I'm not going to play your Pokemon. But then Pocket Mortys, this like super simplistic, complete skinned ripoff of the Pokemon engine set in the Rick and Morty multiverse. It's just so great. It's so perfect. I am really digging it. I was on airplanes. You don't have to be connected to the internet for it. It was so worth it.
Yeah, I'll echo that. I mean, I don't know how much more I'm going to get out of it, maybe another, you know, three or four plays. It's fun. And it's a free-to-play. It's a freemium game that doesn't just, like, continually punch you in the face because you're not, you know, like, it doesn't do
this. You're not forking over money. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't do this super annoying thing that I'm sure they could have, and there are probably pressure on them to do, which is like, oh, you've been playing it too much. All your Mortys are tired. You're going to have to pay to get them woken up again. You know, everything you can do free to play. I really had a good time with it, and you know, it certainly has enough of the humor to sort of sustain the Rick and Morty fan.
Yeah, and it really does help if you're a fan of the show. It's like, so you know, that moment when, you know, Bird Person is like, "I will always be there for you."
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if that's going to be your pick, I'll switch my.
No. I was just trying to.
No, correct. I actually have, because I had two I was thinking of.
Good. Then my pick is Pocket Morty.
Okay. Then my pick will be The Expanse on Sci-Fi. Believe the hype. I dig it. It's good science fiction. Well executed. It's less character driven than something like, say, Battlestar Galactica, but the stars of the show are really the three factions, the Earth, Mars, and the Belters, the Belt, the folks living in Andrew's asteroids. And it's really well told. It kind of, I don't want to say it moves slow, but it's like, it's a very simple arc. I'm five episodes in. And it's cool to see a group of people come together. And at this point, much like some of my favorite science fiction novels, I'm watching three completely independent stories happen, certain that at some point they're going to intersect in fascinating and wonderful ways. And I'm right now, the star of the show is the universe that they've set it up. They have made an epic feeling television show without leaving the solar system. You only need three players. You got a cold war between Earth and Mars, and then the balance is this, and you know, is the and the rest, the third world of the Belters, and the casting is great. Belters, you could tell upon sight because they're super thin and wafy and often tall, whereas Martians are much like you'd expect, you know, very very warlike and precise. And
understand, these are all how humans have evolved to these environments. There's not like there's
correct. Yes. No. Thank you for clarifying that. No, it's great. It's on Sci-Fi. I ended up, my only frustration was for a while they were showing the first few episodes for free on their website, but now you have to authenticate with cable. So, you know, I just shrugged and dropped the $20 to buy the whole season on Amazon, and really, really enjoyed it.
Is the first season done?
No, it's still coming out. I think they're only seven episodes in, but whenever you buy a season, you get the next morning it comes out.
Nice. Yeah.
I watched the first episode and I thought it was the effects. It was beautiful. Very, very, very well done. Very, 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 very smart. Very, very, I won't pick apart their spacesuit design. Cause I'm not that guy. I thought the actors would, but I wasn't engaged. And I was like, I couldn't finish the book because it just moved too slow for me.
Yeah, give it a little more time. I'll tell you, one of the things I like is oftentimes on these shows, you get a little nod to the gravity on a planet. And then after that, they're clearly on Earth walking around like, no, this is Mars or whatever. But because, and they don't beat it over your head, just when they're on an asteroid, you see maybe as an opening shot, somebody pouring themselves some whiskey and they're pouring it a good, 3 inches off to the side, and then it lands, curves off and then lands, which is exactly what you'd expect if your gravity mm-hmm. was created by centripetal motion. And, you see it in combat, and as a form of torture, they hook someone up and just make them experience Earth gravity as they hang there and, their weak Belter's bones barely able to support themselves. I liked it. I believed all of it. I'm digging it a lot.
And, yeah, I thought that part of it, that was so well done. I just was like, all right, like I'm, who am I into? Who am I rooting for? Who am I this?
Well, and that's the best part, right? Like, I have no idea.
All the beautiful people survived this cataclysmic event.
Yeah. Well, and it's great to hear the rhetoric different sides use to portray. It's awesome to not really have a dog in the fight. So you can listen to the Martians explain, it's like, yeah, pitiful earthlings. Our dream
it's,
is to.
It's like Heinlein 1950s, very much that old golden age of what sci-fi, that it's that idea of what that universe would be like.
Yeah. Well, it's like we want to turn Mars into a garden. The earthlings took their gardens and paved them, and you're like, yeah, screw those earthlings. They didn't even know what they were dealt. It's great. I'm liking it a lot.
All right. I have a pick.
Shoot.
I do. I have a pick. Are you guys surprised? You didn't think I had one, did you?
Go.
You're like, Andrew's got his head in his clouds, too busy watching rockets and being afraid of getting stampeded. I have a pick. And this pick came about because it was a two-factor pick. Two things contributed to this pick.
Mm-hmm.
One was some words that came out of Brian Brushwood's mouth. Oh, and he goes, blankety blank was cool, blankety blank, blank, blank. And that made me pay attention to it. So when I saw this, my ears perked up. I'm like, huh, interesting. Ties into Fargo season two. And the end of the episode, I think it was Before the Law. There's, I won't tell you what happens, but music plays. And part of what Fargo season two wanted to do, if I said it in 1979, is 1979 is this very weird sort of period in time. And you had things like 1979 was the 70s. You had the height of UFOs. You had, you know, there is this sort of weird, you know, supernatural element that plays into, you know, Fargo that has really nothing to do with the plot. But I'm okay. I'm totally cool with it because, you know, I'm on my way to the rocket launch. I'm sitting in the car with a friend who's a stylist who's not involved, doesn't know anything about space or science, and is talking about asking everybody what their astrological sign is.
Yeah.
Right? I have friends who believe this stuff or believe in aliens and believe in that kind of stuff. So I have no problem for a story to stay true to how some people might perceive that world. They have these elements to it. So at the end of that episode, they played a piece of music from the Jeff Wayne version of War of the Worlds.
So good. It is an epic rock opera of H.G. Wells's.
Opera.
Yeah, prog rock opera. It's so good. And just listening to the beginning of it, where it's narrated by Sir Richard Burton, is so good.
It is. It's actually now, it's a new West End musical, but it's also on Amazon Prime, which you can download and listen to for free if you're an Amazon Prime Music. So I've had that. I downloaded that entire album on Amazon Prime Music, and I've been listening to it over and over. Late at night, I'll listen to it, you know, and there's stuff that's like, it's, there was a lot of really weird kind of cool, like, concept album stuff in the 70s. Like, even Kiss did Songs of the Elder, which was their own attempt to try to create this big sort of epic kind of thing. This is really cool. So it takes the story of War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. There's music composed toward, and it's, you have Richard Burton narrating. You have other cast members will play certain parts, but it's you know, a scene will get, you know, will be narrated or acted out, and then the music comes in, and then you start to recognize the musical intro for the aliens and for the different stuff, and they tell the story, and Wayne sort of put his own sort of spin on it and created some characters that aren't in there, but you get the overall feeling of the story. It's weird. I mean, you know, nine out of 10 people who are going to check this out will be like, God, is Andrew high? No, never done a drug in my life. This is why. I just dug it. Really, really dug it. I've been listening to it over and over again. So that's Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds. Like we just found out. I mean, it's been redone several, several times. It was a huge selling album back in the day. And I thought it was a really cool.
I didn't discover it until I want to say maybe 7 years ago was the first time I had heard it. And it was like this fully foreign. I was like, how did this escape my consciousness my entire life?
Brian, as far as I know, I didn't know about it until you mentioned it.
Oh, that's awesome. Very cool.
I had no idea this existed until you mentioned it. And I'm like, and I'm listening at the end of the episode. I'm like, that's really cool. Like, let me listen to more. I'm like, oh, that's cool. Like, you know, let me listen to the album. I listened to the whole album. I'm like, this is really cool. And there's like some of the songs on there. Like if you like, you
dude,
know.
The second track, Horsel Common and the Heat Ray, where there's that guitar riff that just sounds like you would imagine the Heat Rays to be. And it's got this lumbering beat to it. And you just picture these giant, you know, stilted walkers. Man, so great.
I like Spirit of Man.
There it is. There it is. Yeah. And you hear the breathing and everything.
They come out. Next morning, a crowd gathered on the common, hypnotized by the unscrewing of the cylinder. 2 feet of shining screw projected when, suddenly, the lid fell off. Two luminous...
Dude, so great. So great.
I mean, all right, so where does War of the Worlds, like... Is War of the Worlds kind of underrated as one of the most important works of fiction, like historically, considering its history and the fact that it's like you know, been repeated so often, right?
Yeah.
It's almost always well received. It was, you know, a futurist story that has remained a kind of futurist story for almost as long as it is.
Well, here's an interesting way to pose that question is, are there very many bad versions of War of the Worlds? Is War of the Worlds such an inherently good story that just about anyone who tries it pulls it off pretty well? Because the Spielberg one was pretty good. The 1950s one that I grew up watching, you know, on reruns on television was good.
And it has like a pedigree that few fictional works has, which is like, it has several times like terrorized the populace, you know, like,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Just Bryce, go to the Wikipedia page and go look into the photo or the illustration from 1906, a Martian fighting machine battling the HMS Thunderchild.
Oh yeah, dude. Such great imagery. And speaking of which, that looks gorgeous.
And just to say, like, to Justin, like your point, like, Wells had, like, he imagined the state, that was the state of the art, you know, that'd be a state of art British ship in that day and age going toe to toe with this alien war machine. And, you know, we're overwhelmed, but you're like, you get this battle, you get this really cool epic battle. And this was a book written over 100 years ago. And there's a wonderful era. And H.G. Wells is really responsible. Jules Verne was really fanciful. H.G. Wells did great science fiction. And there's such a great, you know, period of you had there and you had 5 or 6 years later, you got a Princess of Mars and you listen to the airship and the fighting. Like, one of the disappointing things about John Carter of Mars, among many, is like there were really cool aerial battle sequences and stuff written in a book, you know, when airplanes were this untested thing that may never work.
Well, one of my favorite parts about the Jeff Wayne version of War of the Worlds is that it's set in the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. And it just has me so hungry to see a period correct version of this. You know, the way we enjoy, versions of Sherlock Holmes and so on. How great would it be to see science fiction set in that time period?
I agree. I thought that the production that... I like Spielberg's version of it. I thought that he did a really good job of that. I think that the 1953 version, I really dug. You know, they set it contemporary to there, and that feels a lot closer to 1898 than now. I thought that was a really well done version of it. And I'm trying to think of if there was ever a... I know there have been like some super low budget knockoff ones of it, but I don't know if there's ever been a good.
The thing that I find so interesting about it is that for a science fiction story that is as old as it is, it still retains menace. And obviously, mm-hmm. I think some of that comes from the applications of it and their kind of notorious ramifications. But it's like, you know, how many horror stories even like. You know, retain menace or bite. Like we think of Frankenstein as interesting, right? But we don't think of Frankenstein as scary or Dracula as scary, right? They are certainly things that have held. They are still interesting ideas to us. But it's like War of the Worlds still seems like dangerous. Like,
well, it's relevant, right? It's like, how loud do we want to be broadcasting that? Hey, lots of intelligent life down here for anyone who cares.
Yeah. Or like, it's like the idea of like, yeah, well, if somebody did it really interesting right now in a small town, somebody might get stampeded because people were scared. Right. Like, you know, there's just this idea of it. There's an aura around it that like, I can't think of many things that are that old that remain that vibrant.
It's – and the ideas in there, if you go to look at the Wikipedia page, you look it up and they say that Robert Goddard, who's the father of rocketry using liquid fuels and multi-stage, that he was influenced by this book, and you had a generation of – you have science fiction authors who were born of that age or kids during that period or shortly thereafter who were hugely influenced by the works of H.G. Wells. And this is a guy that's talked about like, well, what would it be like if aliens evolved on Mars and what do we think about Mars and – what would they look like? And, you know, would they evolve faster? And what kind of technology would they have? And it is a wonderful work. And it was neat to see, you know, this Jeff Wayne thing to sort of rekindle that interest in it, in that version of the story, as opposed to later versions, which I think are really good. But yeah, I think I love the idea of doing I'm looking at a period piece. And I think there's a 2005 film, H.G. Wells. And it looks like it's an independent production, and the poster is not exactly inspiring. but you know, I think that would be a neat thing to see, have it done in that time period.
Hey guys, before we wrap up, can I plug something?
Yeah.
So, oh, I got to plug the expansion pack for the Contender, by the way.
Oh, geez, you son of a... I mean, I'll tell you what, you're really smart. Yeah, so here's the deal. When we did the Contender Kickstarter, we put out this politically incorrect expansion, right? So the idea is that we do this whole 500 cards, and then we realize, well, you want to know what? It's fairly easy for us to make it family-friendly if we just cut out a few F-words and a few things that would just be a little bit over the edge. We didn't have that many in there. So we did. We made it family-friendly. The base deck available at thecontender.us or on Amazon is family-friendly. But all those nasty curse words, all those foul ideas we put into this blue-faced deck. So if you are a family, you can play with these when the kids are in bed and then easily sort them out because you can tell them apart. And really the only complaint that we've had since we've released the game is when this Kickstarter exclusive, if it would ever go back on sale. So for 1 week to preserve the exclusivity of the Kickstarter exclusive, we are going to put these on sale. They're on sale right now. TheContender.us, the only place you can buy them. You can get them now. Friday at midnight Pacific Standard Time, we put them back in the famed Contender Vault, and they will be there, and you will not have them if you don't buy them right now. So go ahead and check it out. TheContender.us, 50 card expansion, $10. Bye now.
Sounds like a fun time to be had by all.
It's got my favorite topic in the game, which is your child. So you debate over your child.
Oh,
which is
give us a little taste, a little.
What was that?
Can you give us a little taste of?
If you this is a family friendly podcast, so you know you would say the topic would be your child, and I could just start out by letting everybody know that Muslims love your child, and then you could respond with, well, a great idea, Hitler.
Who said that?
That is John McCain saying, we allowed Hitler to come to power with that kind of attitude and isolationism and appeasement.
That's amazing.
Listen, you could always then go after somebody with a, we want a world unmolested by your child, which is from a Steve Forbes quote. So listen, it's some of my favorite cards are in there. Including this, oh man, I don't even know if I want to say what's on this card, but the Richard Nixon quote is, I can't shake hands with anyone from San Francisco, decorators.
Wow.
So, yeah, very fun. Check it out, thecontender.us.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.